This is FUV Live Sessions, a podcast brought to you by WFUV in New York City. Each week, we talk to artists in our Bronx studio or at venues around the city like this, and we listen to them play a live set. You'll get to hear the songs and learn about the artist or band. Episodes drop every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on all the latest episodes and to find your next favorite artist or band. And if you like what you hear, please make sure that you rate and review the show so other music lovers can find it. This is FUV Live Sessions with They Might Be Giants. I'm Megan Suma, and I'm here with host Benham Jones at WFUV. Benham, you grew up on They Might Be Giants. You actually mention it to them in the interview. So talk to me about this kind of full circle moment, watching the band live and getting to talk to them in the green room before the show about this latest album.
Yeah, very full circle, and probably the rare occasion when I will say it is okay to meet your heroes. Incredibly nice guys, just music heads. They wanted to talk about their history and also kind of just the history of music in general. And it was fun to kind of walk down memory lane with them. And also we had some mutual friends. I have a friend that I grew up with who ended up repressing one of their iconic albums, Flood, on vinyl. So that was a very full circle moment. And yeah, for me, the most embarrassing part is when I asked them, you know, what they've been listening to, what they've been enjoying lately, and they flipped it back on me. And I was so nervous, I didn't really know what to say. So I just told them about the show, the last show I'd gone to that week. And honestly, I kind of wish that I had been able to do the interview after I saw their performance. It was cool with the anticipation in the green room, but honestly, it was such an incredible show at the Sheen Center that I kind of wish I'd been able to pick their brain. That would have been the best prep I could have had for sitting down with They Might Be Giants. But it was it was a pleasure, kind of front to back. And I think you'll hear it in the interview.
And what is the first live song from the Sheen Center for WFUV that we're going to hear in this session?
The first song we're going to hear is Dr. Worm, live from the Sheen Center. This is They Might Be Giants on FUV Live Sessions.
Good evening, everybody. We're so excited to be here, ladies and gentlemen. We just woke up. I'll let you in on a little secret. We're used to playing for drunks. And playing at 7 o'clock, there, no, it's not.
We're also used to it being 85 degrees.
Yes, yes.
In the room.
You know, this is delightfully air-conditioned. The oxygen particles are plentiful. It's a real step up for us. So, in keeping with the classy tone, we'd like to introduce another song featuring Mr. Dan Miller, center stage, where he's belonged the entire time on the keyboards. This song is called Dr. Worm.
I
They Might Be Giants live at the Sheen Center. Benham Jones sitting down with the Johns. Yes, thank you guys so much for being here. What's up? Thanks for doing this for the station. New record is out, and it's a big new tour. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I'm just kind of curious. You're like several dozen albums in. When you approach a new record, is it kind of like a fresh reset, or does it all feel in the continuity of the larger picture of what you guys
Well, it's always challenging to say, you know, because the question is like, so what's different about the new album?
Mm-hmm.
And nothing. Very often we're like, we just made another record. I don't know. You know.
So I'm like, imagine I am 13 years old and a They Might Be Giants record comes out. It's called Mink Car.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to some people before I was told them I was going to be interviewing y'all. And they're like, yeah, you know, and we know the classics, Flood and stuff. I grew up in Southern Connecticut. So we had this guy, Matt Flood, who ran Asbestos Records, who we all called Flood because you were his favorite band. And that was his favorite record. And I think actually on the 30th anniversary of the album, he actually repressed it on vinyl. Long story short, I would tell people, I'm 13 years old, I buy Mink Car, I love it. That's like my moment with They Might Be Giants. And I was talking to some They Might Be Giants super fans before this interview, and they're like, I don't know what record you're talking about.
Right, fair enough. Yeah.
Well, that was a sort of our, I mean, this is a kind of a Shaggy Dog story with no point really, but like that's the only record we ever made that went out of print and kind of disappeared because we were on an independent label right after we got off our deal with Elektra, and we did this record, Mink Car, and we spent a lot of time on it. It was going to be sort of like, you know, trying to kind of shooting for radio stuff and on it and everything. And then 9/11 happened and our record company went out of business instantly.
Mm.
And it even like didn't, there was a long interval of time when it wasn't on, you know, iTunes or anything, which is very odd to have a record actually disappear.
Well, for me, it was like the moment in time. It's the first record of yours that I bought with my own money.
There you go.
I was saving like lunch money and stuff and going up to the record store when I was a kid. So what does make this record different for y'all?
Well, you know, this is the first thing we've done really since the pandemic. Like making our last record turned into much more of a crucible because we hadn't finished it before the pandemic started, and then everything that just shut everything down, shut that book project down.
This might be the longest interval between albums that we've ever had.
Yeah. I got hit by a car. I got hit by a car and was really, I was in the hospital for a week and it took months to recover and that took a really long time. That nobody was expecting that.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff happens, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes you kind of get sidetracked, but, you know, still no rehab, still no, you know, we're doing okay.
Yeah. When I first looked at the track list, before I got the record, I saw the track list, I saw there's a song called Overnight Sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always like, if I interview They Might Be Giants, I want to talk about Zappa. I want to talk about Ween. But it's actually not a Zappa song.
Not a Zappa reference. No, yeah. It's the Raspberries.
Yeah.
It's a cover of a Raspberries song.
And he recently passed away, right?
He did. Yeah.
Eric Carmen did the song All By Myself. That was his really big hit. Yeah. And we're sort of finding out that a lot of people don't even know the song at all. It was probably a minor hit to the Raspberries.
It wasn't one of their big hits, which is very funny.
Mm-hmm. But it's memorable. It's a great production. Like, they do all sorts of crazy, there's like flange drums and stuff on the original version.
Yeah. But there's this whole wacky middle section where they start repeating the chorus, but it's as if it's coming out of an AM radio. And then gradually the sound gets bigger until it's back to the full bandwidth version. And it's a very kind of a broad kind of production, like super big production of a song.
It's got some bombast. We kind of streamlined it a little bit.
A little bit.
Made it a little bit more power pop. I mean, the Raspberries are an original power pop band, but that their version of Overnight Sensation is a little bit Baroque. It's got some pretty juicy sax solos in it.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Kurt about this, and he was pointing out, like, that was kind of a moment where it had almost like a punk rock attitude, which is, it's like referring to AM radio, but it's clearly a thing that's kind of in the past. Like, the Raspberries were doing something that was already kind of retro in the early 70s. They were not, they didn't sound contemporary. They were wearing matching outfits and stuff. So there was something like oddly, you know, in quotation marks about their music.
Yeah.
They were kind of provincial.
I love those. Like Tommy James and the Shondells, they have some things when they get, you could tell that they're Tommy James and the Shondells, and then they discovered weed.
Right.
And like then they get yeah. very psychedelic at the end of Mirage, and uh-huh. you know, Crimson and Clover does the yeah, same yeah, thing yeah, too. Yeah. But I love that those places where pop just goes, it veers left, and they're like, we won't be held here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a couple of really ripe Tommy James records. They're great. Yeah, and you know, they were actually, I read his book, which is fascinating, because, you know, his manager was the guy who ran Strawberry's Records. Mm-hmm. We both worked at this record store in Harvard Square, and the guy who, Mo Levy, who ran Roulette Records, sort of a notorious dude.
Thug,
criminal, convict. Yeah, he's not a nice guy, but the book is called Me, My Music, and the Mob. And he's
oh, wow.
And that's Tommy great. James's
that's
book?
That's his book, yeah. It's, yeah. It's a very
that sounds really worth checking
sexy,
out.
Sexy read.
Yeah, he has got a radio show, actually.
Yeah.
Sirius.
Yeah, he's on Sirius. But they recorded those records really close to where we are right now. In a basement studio, and he talks about how they like have to stop recording in the middle because the subway cars would come by and like rattle the studio, mm-hmm.
and tough guys would come by
yeah,
too.
Tough guys. Yeah.
Benham Jones in conversation with John Linnell, John Flansburgh, another tune from the show at the Sheen Center. They Might Be Giants on FUV.
This next song, we want to thank WFUV for playing the song on the radio. It's been a total thrill. Every couple of days, somebody comes up to me and says, like, I heard your song on WFUV. And it's like, yes. Yes. This is the lead single off our brand new album, and it's called Wu-Tang.
Benham Jones in conversation with John Linnell, John Flansburg of They Might Be Giants on a, what are you calling the tour? Is the bigger show?
The bigger show. It's just we ran out of names.
Can you tell me a little bit about the setup for the tour?
Sure.
The band and what you're doing?
Well, it's the five piece that we've had for forever now at this point. Our drummer joined 25 years ago and he's the new guy in the band. And then we have a three piece horn section, sax, trumpet, trombone, and they trade off and play other stuff as well. So it's a big, it's eight people on stage. Everybody's a big show off. And it's comforting for John and I because, you know, we started out as a duo and we were scared back then. But now we have all these people there to keep us company.
It's funny, I was listening to, I can't remember. I mean, I was listening to one of the classic records and I actually said out loud, "Oh, the breaking of the fourth wall."
Oh, wow. Interesting.
On Particle Man or something. I can't remember. But yeah, a little bit about the experience of being in the studio versus playing live with a giant band. Or how are you making records now?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think John and I both really take like the challenge of songwriting as like the primary thing that like we sort of struggle with. And the nice part of doing shows is that in a way, you know, we're just kind of celebrating the output, you know, like we're doing two sets and the first set of each night changes while we're doing these multi-night stands. And so we'll be doing like, 10 songs off of Lincoln and 10 songs off of John Henry and 10 songs off of, Factory Showroom. So we're doing like all these different in Mink Car. We do a Mink Car show. You're invited.
I'll send you an email. We
don't tell anybody in advance, but I'll tell you. It's a lot to draw on. You know, I mean, there are not a lot of things that would recommend being in a band for 40 years, but I would say having a lot of really solid repertoire is a bonus.
But we had to do, we did more rehearsing than we normally do because we have a lot of material that we're trying to keep in the show, and B, because our memory is starting to fail. So it is real. It's incredibly hard to remember.
I saw this photograph of Pete Townshend with like a teleprompter that was like 9 feet tall in front of him, and it said something like, "They're all wasted."
Wow!
It was like something that you would think like would be very hard.
That's really funny. He doesn't even sing that line.
I know. I think he's just getting the feed that goes to Roger Daltrey.
Right. Yeah. No, we'll be getting the giant sports, you know, sports jumbotron.
Yes, you deserve it.
Yeah. No, I don't know. You know, I saw a show at Madison Square Garden a couple of years ago. It was like sort of set up like a variety show. There's like one main person, but there were a lot of cameos. And every single person was singing off a teleprompter. And I found it so distracting because I was just like, come on. Like, this is Carnegie Hall. At Carnegie Hall. Hmm. And it was like, I'm sure many people invited their parents. Like, you invited your parents, but you didn't memorize the song.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, in classical music, it's completely normal to have your music in front of you.
Like, right.
Even and presumably some people have memorized.
Why are they so lazy, Chuck?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Now, what was that thing that happened just a couple of months ago? Some woman was about to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There was a thing in the news.
She was playing like a piano concerto and the conductor started and she realized like she'd rehearsed for the wrong thing or they had told her the wrong thing, but she already had memorized the piano concerto that they were going into. So she just knew it by heart and just bombed into it and nailed it, apparently.
We used to be a proper civilization.
We used to have a country.
to have a country and a civilization and brains. Everyone's a touch of cyborg now, though, the teleprompter or the, the wearable tech.
Yeah.
Our special thing is that we wipe out on stage and we're just talk about how we screwed up.
Yeah, know? That's how
the audience loves that.
That's how we break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Is we're bad at our jobs. Get down. Get down.
Said down. Get down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Did you make the record with this band?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Very much so.
Sick.
Yeah.
In the writing process, it starts with just you two, or do you bring demos to the band?
Yeah.
Yeah, we both write. We have project studios, and sometimes we'll bring in stuff that's quite complete. You know, like the arrangement is really, like there'll be instruments that are on the demo that are going to be on the final album, especially like the weirder sounds. Like, it's one of the nice things about modern recording, you know. It's funny, like when I read interviews, people are always slagging like digital recording. But, you know, you can make stuff at your in your house. I mean, that's like an incredibly liberating thing. It's like super fun to, you know, get some really twizzly, you know, kind of indefensible sound going in your project studio and finish a song around it and then like actually amp it up with a band.
The point is, when we started, you couldn't do that. Like, mm-hmm. you couldn't take your demo and integrate it into the final version without it. I mean, it, you know, I guess that was the problem. That was the controversy about Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska.
Yeah.
Was that he literally took the demo and just put it out.
Right.
But it was only after like a lot of tearing out of hair and, you know, fighting. And.
But it's funny because we're in a culture, a music culture, where everybody recognizes that demos are often the coolest thing ever. So it's like if you can find a way to bridge that or something, it seems like very worthwhile.
Yeah. And I guess when you guys started, it was probably just at the groundbreaking of like the Tascam and the Nebraska kind of home recording
stuff. There were, I had a 4-track open reel machine. I mean, the weirdest technological innovation that happened during the course of our first like 5 years is that there really weren't drum machines when we started. Mm. And we started as a band, as a duo with a drum machine. So like we were like waiting for it to arrive for a little while.
But I think we did, at some point we did have a cassette 4-track, I believe. I mean, I seem to recall. And I had a cassette 8-track at a certain point in my projects.
Oh, wow.
That was,
incredible bandwidth.
I know, amazing.
I know we don't have too much time, but like I said, I always said if I would sit down with you guys, I just want to talk to them about music. But I realize it's so hard to geolocate yourself culturally, especially a band with as diverse a repertoire as you have. So with all things equal, you know, be it music, and I was thinking about Zappa and Ween. I always think about those as touchstones for y'all. Ween, because a duo as well. But in the same breath, I always relate you guys to Calvin and Hobbes and Pee Wee Herman and like this sort of anarchic humor that seems apolitical, but within its anarchy, it has like a resistance that's interesting to me. But I'm just curious about what you think of influenced you, brought you here, and what do you think about the stuff that you've influenced?
Well, I'm glad you said political.
Yeah.
I
believe I said apolitical.
We've answered this question before, and I'm always trying to think of some more interesting way to frame it. But obviously, John and I are of a generation that where the Beatles were kind of like the foundation thing, and then this thing evolved, which at the time was called underground rock. And it was kind of a catch-all thing for just like very eclectic music that was played on FM radio. And that, you know, that was sort of what defined music at that point. And the other thing was when I met John, he was also very into music from before there was rock, you know. He had an Andrews Sisters 78 nailed to his bedroom wall, and
it was on a nail.
So that was, you know, so I think we just accepted this idea that like, you know, anything that seemed interesting was fair game. And we've talked about the one of the very first musical things we did together was a version of Yoko Ono's "Don't Worry, Kyoko, Mummy's Only Looking for a Hand in the Snow,"
which I actually listened to on Spotify just the other day and checked out. And I realized that the way we were actually very reverent to the way she sang it.
Oh, yeah?
Even though we were doing like a Rod Serling.
We were doing Rod Serling impressions. to both of us were doing Rod Serling
our
impressions.
Our best Rod Serling. Yeah. But we were doing the rhythms of her vocal very, very respectfully.
Right.
I mean, something that... For, you know, my mother would say, "What is that screaming?"
right. Yeah. Right. We were covering it faithfully, yeah. You know, on those terms.
With respect.
I was actually playing the Yoko Ono Fly album like a couple of years ago in my living room in my apartment, and my wife Robin came in and was like, "What is this?" And it's funny because, you know, she like totally respects Yoko Ono as like a, you know, a feminist.
Right.
But she was just like, "This music is crazy."
Right.
Anything you guys have heard recently that you're enjoying? Anything?
Well, I don't know their name, but this French group that wears the polka dot outfits.
Right.
French Canadian.
Angine.
Yeah. Poitrine. They're like a math rock group from Quebec somewhere. I think they're kind of fantastic, and I'm even more delighted that the world seems to be celebrating.
Yeah,
them.
Why are they so popular?
You know, I mean, to me, I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking like, did I see these guys at, you know, the Pyramid Club in 1985?
Right.
You know,
exactly.
I mean, it's so straight out of the East Village. Like, I mean, not the Rush, not the math rock part so much, but just the outfits, the look, the vibe, the thing.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I think it's very spirited and cool. And it's great that, I guess it's the perfect platform, like social media, like TikTok and Instagram are like the perfect ways to get a taste of something like that.
Well, I think what's cool about them is that they are doing something that would have been considered sort of elitist jazz or math rock kind of thing, but they have a presentation that makes it somehow this mass appeal thing. It's kind of confusing, actually,
yeah.
That way.
But now they're huge. I mean, yeah. They're instantly huge.
Yeah, like Buckethead took years for Buckethead.
But don't you think like Buckethead is in some dressing room somewhere shaking his fist at the mirror going, why?
I think I can do
math rock too.
Yes.
Right.
So Angine Poitrine, anything else, even not musical, that has been interesting to y'all lately? I'm always curious.
Nothing good. Nothing really caught my eye.
Hmm. I mean, I usually turn to my son for, you know, whatever's contemporary, and he hasn't recommended anything recently. But I think...
What would you recommend to They Might Be Giants?
What would I recommend to They Might Be Giants that I've enjoyed
just
recently?
Remember where... Snobs.
You're right. Snobs.
Right.
And we hate music. And yet we're populists.
Yeah. I saw the Dirty Three at Pioneer Works a couple weeks ago.
The Dirty Three? Who were they?
That's Jim White on the drums, Mick Turner on guitar, and Warren Ellis playing the fiddle. So they're three Australian scumbags who played in this bar for a long time, and then they became members of the Bad Seeds with Nick Cave. They also backed up Cat Power on her first couple records.
Okay.
But it's basically because they got paid to play these three-hour bar gigs, all their songs are like 40 minutes long. And they're just like violin crescendos played through a Marshall stack.
Whoa.
I already love it.
And Jim White on the drums, who lives in New York now, but just seeing him play is like a full masterclass.
Cool.
So if I would recommend catching that live.
Okay.
I saw it on Good Friday.
I had dinner with a friend, old friend of mine, and he told me I have to check out Juana Molina. He said that was, I'm getting a nod.
Mm-hmm. Knowing nods.
Yeah, I still haven't heard Juana's work.
Knowing nods, yeah. But yeah, that was like the most recent. Yeah, I mean, that's not a new thing, but that was something that like stopped me in my tracks.
Cool.
Seeing that live was pretty cool.
Okay, good name, guys.
Thank you. Are we about at time? About there.
Well, thank you for your time.
No, the pleasure's all mine. Like I said,
get some of the pleasure.
It's in my DNA.
Give
though,
me
Asbestos
that pleasure.
Records.
Like yeah,
the,
yeah.
The Scott community of New Haven were ride or die, They Might Be Giants fans.
Yeah, the love is strong.
In the 90s.
Yeah, and that Flood guy, he really helped us out in some very fallow times.
Yeah, he's a good dude. Well, thank you so much. Benham Jones in conversation with They Might Be Giants, going back to the Sheen Center for more from the Bigger Show Tour.
Find a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little bird out. Live audience, have a great night.
That was They Might Be Giants performing and in conversation at the Sheen Center in New York City for WFUV. A big thank you to the whole band for this exclusive show, for the station, and to the Johns for sitting down with me to talk beforehand. Thanks to Scott Bozak of Big Big Productions for the songs you heard in this episode, and to the entire team at the Sheen Center. Our FUV Live in-studio sessions are engineered by Jim O'Hara. Our associate producer for this episode was Diana Juarez. Megan Suma is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by John Crick. Be sure to follow FUV Live Sessions wherever you get your podcasts so you can listen to new episodes and find your next favorite artist, band, album, or song. Episodes drop every Monday. Please rate and review the show if you like what you hear so other music lovers can find it too. You can also catch audio and video of FUV Live Sessions on WFUV.org. FUV Live Sessions is a production of WFUV in New York City. I'm your host, Benham Jones.